ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on the American Freedom Radio Network 5 days a week, 2 hours a day, for your daily dose of comedy and conspiracy. It's the lighter side of genocide. Because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go freaking nuts. And my very special guests today... Yes, and I do realize I call everybody my very special guests because everybody's so special. Anthony Peake, who's kind of a dude who knows about the science of life after death. I've had him on the show before. And somebody I have not had on the show before, who we'll introduce first, Thomas Campbell. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Vinny. Glad to be here.
Do you just let us know what your expertise is, my son?
My expertise? Well, by profession, I'm a physicist. Okay, specialized in nuclear physics, but that with a day job, my night job was working in a lab with Bob Monroe studying consciousness. So that's really why I'm here, not as a physicist so much as a student of consciousness.
And all right,
yeah.
Well, it helps actually to be kind of on that that ironic twist, don't you think?
Well, I think it helps a whole lot to have both going at the same time. You can understand consciousness much better if you have a good basis in science, and you can, you know, the two work well with each other. You can understand actually physics better with a good basis in consciousness and metaphysics as well.
But, of course, there are those, of course, who are absolutely and utterly in denial that consciousness has anything to do with science of any kind, and they're simply... very close-minded about it. I presume you know of these kind of people.
I've met one or two of them in my time, yes.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate incident. Anthony Peake is also with us. Welcome, Anthony.
Hello there. Hi. How are you doing? How are you doing, Tom? Nice to be linked up with you again.
Yeah, doing fine, Anthony. Yeah, nice that we get to talk together another time.
Absolutely.
Mm-mm-mm. And Anthony, would you explain to the audience just a little bit about what you do as well?
Right, my area is rather similar to Tom's in the sense that I'm actually trying to do the science of consciousness and the science of bringing together physics, consciousness, and just general perceptions, really, as to how we perceive reality and what reality is. What is particularly interesting is that Tom and I have discussed issues a couple of times in the past, and I'm very much moving towards Tom's position on a lot of things, which is the idea that consciousness is the prime source of everything, and physical matter is very much a manifestation of consciousness rather than the other way around.
Now, apparently Wired magazine came out with an article not too long ago saying that they found evidence out there in the stars or something like that, that all of this universe and everything that we see that's physical is in fact probably a computer program.
Yes, I would agree with that. That's where my position starts as well, is that this is a virtual reality. And that you've seen that in Wired, but you know, when I first wrote these books, you didn't see that anywhere. There was Fredkin, and there was maybe a fellow over in England who thought that was a good idea, a virtual reality. But now, every week or two, I see another... you know, scientific paper on why virtual reality is really the best physics. So it's a thing that's coming. It's an idea whose time has come, it seems. It's beginning to be a landslide in favor of that because it's just better physics. You can do physics problems better on that assumption than anything else. And, of course, once you take the next step after that, which is, well, okay, it's a big computer, then it's like, well, who's programming and, you know, why and how and that sort of stuff. And then those answers lead you to consciousness, which then leads you to metaphysics, philosophy, and all the rest of that stuff.
Yeah, I totally agree with Tom there as well, because I've found this, that it's suddenly very much in vogue now, this idea of the computer simulation. But I think, as Tom was saying there, I mean, I think it's Nick Bostrom that Tom was very much mentioning there. Yeah. And it's been very much, you know, an area of interest of quite a few of us for quite a few years now. But I'm delighted to see that it is now getting more into the mainstream, because as Tom says, you know, this is one of the things that effectively explains everything. You know, it's a total theory rather than a selective explanator of exactly what experience is.
Now, what do you say to skeptics who would say, oh, you guys are just crazy?
Well, I would...
Before you answer that, I went to a skeptics meeting one time and they were very, very positive about GMO food. And I told them about an article that said that Monsanto doesn't serve GMO food in its cafeterias. And they... And they had a look for the article, and they say, oh, well, this is a skeptics meeting, and the websites that this is on are like beforeitsnews.com and that kind of thing. And I say, oh, really? Is that what a skeptic is? Somebody who only believes the mainstream take on things and says that everything else is BS without looking at it.
Well, you know, Vincent, there's only three requirements for a skeptic. One, they have to have a belief. Two, a mouth. And three, an audience. Nothing else is required. So, that puts a lot of
brains
people
in the
skeptic
game. Okay. Well, anyway, continue on with your explanation of what you would do. In fact, that's a good thing to say to the skeptics or everything. You've got a mouth, an opinion, and an audience, but that's all you got, mate. Sorry.
Yeah, that's all that's required. And, I'm a big favor of skepticism. Matter of fact, one of my bylines phrase I keep repeating over and over in my book is you need two things to find truth. One is open-mindedness, and the two is skepticism. Because if you only have one of those but not the other, you're in trouble. So it takes both of those to find truth. So if I run into skeptics, if they were science types, if these were people who actually had, degrees in physics or other sciences, I would basically... challenge them on the basis of physics, in that virtual reality just answers more questions. It's better physics. It explains more things with fewer problems than does the other model. We have problems with what happened before the Big Bang. Where did that Big Bang come from? Our whole universe, which according to them is the only reality that there is, well, it didn't exist until after the Big Bang. Where'd all that energy get wadded up in that little point that could go bang and create this universe if there's nothing else other than this universe? You see, there's a little problem there. A universe doesn't create itself, does it? We've got this universe that is expanding. Expanding into what? If this universe is all the reality there is, then what is it that this universe is expanding into? You see, there's lots of problems like this, and that's just a couple of them. You have other problems with... things that places like Paralabs have been doing research for the last 30 years in mind affecting matter. They have people using their intent to modify random distributions, robots that are wobbling around on tape. There's lots of things. They've done this in lots of different ways. Their results are better than 1 in a billion. I should put it this way. It's less than 1 in a billion that their results could have just been circumstance, just good luck that they just happened to guess the answers right, so they have huge statistical significance. And, this concept of virtual reality, along with my concept of consciousness, can explain to them why they get those results. How is it that mind can affect matter? How come there is such thing as a placebo effect, where you tell somebody something like, oh, this pill will cure, your problem, and 30 or 40%, it actually cures the problem. Or makes them a lot better. Not just makes them think they're feeling better, but actually, cures their problem. So we have all of these, effects. We know how intent modifies reality. I mean, these experiments have been done over and over and over. You tell a teacher and a bunch of kids that this is the dumb class, and that's the smart class, and guess what? Years down the line, those kids in the dumb class aren't doing as well as those kids in the smart class, and there wasn't any difference at all between them. They were just randomly picked. How come that is? If mind doesn't, if matter just is kind of in charge of everything, right, and you are just what you are, and what would a little talk have to do with that? Well, intent changes reality, and there's a mechanism for how that works. It's just part of the way reality works.
That's what I would say
to the skeptic, is look at the facts.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine was inducted into the Aeronautical Engineering School of Auckland University, and they told him and everybody else that you're the smartest people in this school. Everybody else is dumb compared to you, and yada, yada, yada. And, it's interesting. People who go into incredibly high fields like that, who get told that they're really brilliant and that they're better than everybody else, go on to be a whole real pack of douchebags who think they're better than everybody else.
Yeah, they just come away with that assumption that if they don't know it and they don't understand it, then it couldn't possibly exist or be true.
Yeah, and I love the explanation of the Big Bang. Everything came from nothing. What?
Yeah, sounds mystical, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think making Shiite Muslim up. Anthony, yes, your take?
I was going to say that it's exactly the same when we start discussing the idea of exactly what consciousness is. You know, the idea that I have behind my eyes and somewhere I feel located inside my head, a conscious being that reacts to reality. Now, effectively, again, the Australian philosopher David Chalmers very much calls this the hard problem of science. The idea, how is it that basically inanimate matter, electrical impulses within inorganic and organic material can bring about the concept of a three-dimensional human being with hopes, fears, anticipations, the whole thing. Now, modern science cannot explain this. It's the hard problem. And, of course, until we realize that there is a consciousness that exists, we've got a problem. Now, you talk to a lot of the real arch-skeptics, the people that are known as the materialist reductionists. They will turn around to you and they will say, well, because we can't quantify it, because consciousness does not have extension in space, it therefore doesn't exist. And there are people like Daniel Dennett and the Churchlands and various other neurologists who come across with these ideas that there is nothing. I mean, Dan Dennett, amazingly enough, in one of his books, turns around and says that there really is nothing going in. There really is just a ghost in the machine. It's an illusion. We are fooling ourselves into believing we're conscious. My question to Dennett has always been, and I'd love to ask him this, to be fooled, you have to be aware of the fact that you're being fooled. If there's nothing there, how can anything be fooled if there's nothing there to be fooled in the first place?
The world is full of paradoxes like that, isn't it?
Also,
here's another thing. I've got this old saying, right, guys, that the man who thinks he knows everything obviously knows nothing. And the man who thinks that he knows nothing probably knows enough. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the idea, isn't it, that we meet these people all the time, and I don't know if Tom is the same, but when I lecture and talk, there is always the wise guy who knows everything. And the one thing I'm amazed with is my amazing ignorance of so many subjects. And it really is true. The more you know, the less you know. I think it was Socrates that made that statement, and it is so very true. It's like, as well, modern science has this preoccupation with naming things. You know, the idea is because we call it dark matter, we've explained it. We call it the Big Bang. Oh, we now have explained it because it's a Big Bang. But, of course, all this is a cult of naming. It's a cult of control. But the reality is that we don't understand it. And this is what's amazing about Tom's books, you know, that Tom very much goes into the physics of exactly how his arguments come together. And I'm trying to come from the neurological side. And effectively, Tom and I are kind of meeting in the middle. I'm going from the neurology, he's coming from the big issues, and I'm coming from the small ones. And there's a meeting of minds. But I think Tom would agree with me that we're on our way to finding out. And I think that probably people like Tom and myself are totally open-minded, but not to be open-minded enough that your brains fall out.
Well, in fact, there was an interesting video that was explaining the concept of open-mindedness, and a dude was sitting outside somebody else's house, and there was a desk lamp, and the desk lamp was shining on a wispy kind of a curtain of some description, and there was an image projected on the wall of a ghost-like figure, and he was trying to convince his neighbor that he saw a ghost, and the neighbor was trying to convince him, no, you didn't see a ghost, you just didn't know what it was you were seeing because you didn't actually really have a look at it. And what I found was very interesting about the point of this video is that it was trying to criticize basically open-mindedness by saying that if you are open-minded, it means you're gullible and you're an idiot and you don't actually research into things. So what is very interesting about Thomas's perspective there when he says you need to be skeptical and open-minded at the same time, you need to allow new information but verify it before you send it downstream, as it were.
Yes, and you know, there's one other ingredient to that. You do have to be skeptical and open-minded, because if you're skeptical and not open-minded, you're trapped with your beliefs. You can't learn anything new, and if you're open-minded but not skeptical, you can walk down any you know, you can be led down any path and not be critical of whether it makes sense or not. But the other thing is you have to be able to live gracefully with uncertainty. That's a very important part of it. Because if you're open-minded, which means you don't jump to conclusions and beliefs and have an answer for every, you know, for everything, you have to realize there's a lot of things you don't know. And when you don't know something, what we do is tend to believe something in that, you know, in that space of that ignorance. We fill that ignorance up. We cover it over with a belief. So now we have a belief that makes us feel better because, oh, we know it. Like, you know, like the naming, it's the same thing. We give it a name and now we feel better because we can convince ourselves we know it. So you have to be able to live gracefully with uncertainty and be in that space where you say, well, you know, a ghost in the living room, well, I don't know, maybe. Let's look into it. And I'll give it, from my past experience, about a 10% chance of being true and about a 90% chance that there's something else going on in there. But let's look into it. And then as you get data, you adjust that percentage from maybe 10 to 90 to maybe 50-50, depending on, you know, whatever. So it's a lifetime's work of trying to reduce that uncertainty, you know, around your skepticism.
Yeah, well, I think you mentioned my three favorite words, which are I don't know. I believe everything I know to be true is probably wrong. I just haven't seen the evidence yet that proves how wrong I am, and I can't wait to. I love being proved wrong because it means I learn something for a change. We'll be right back after the break with Tom Campbell and Anthony Peake. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the banjo-playing show that's toothless with silver polish on shotguns on a back porch of some description down in Louisiana. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and, incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Hey, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, James Wright from Occupy Freemasonry, I need to give out a quick mention here today, is living in his car at the moment. He hasn't had a shower in a couple of days. He is hungry, and he is in real trouble. So if you can send some money to him, if you go to facebook.com/Occupy Freemasonry, I think there's a link there to his J Dallas, Texas, J-A-Y Dallas, Texas, at hotmail.com, I think, is his PayPal account. Send him some money, because at the moment he's just having a bum he's having a bum Wi-Fi off of hotel parking lots. And if you can't find that for him, send me the money. Go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, click donate, and make sure you put a note in there. This is for James Wright to survive. Okay, he's in real trouble. Okay, this is the biggest whistleblower in Freemasonry, like, history, okay, since way back in the day, in real trouble right now because of what he's doing, trying to expose the Supreme Council of the 33rd degree. So, you know, please support him. This is kind of what I try to do all the time, is just support the people who actually really need it, when they really, really need it. So please, ladies and gentlemen, this is deadly freaking serious. Deadly serious. Now, back to the show. My very special guests, Thomas Campbell and Anthony Peake. And we've been having a few laughs over the break. I think Anthony described the last show that we did as getting more bizarre and more bizarre as time goes on. And I think we've kind of started off on a note of the world and reality and the universe is, in fact, a computer program. Let's see how much more bizarre we can get. I think that's quite of a test of character, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, we can do that.
Certainly.
Yeah. Now, in terms of weird things that are unexplained by general science but can be explained by the virtual reality science, is there any examples you guys can flick off?
Oh, sure. Lots of them. Matter of fact, you bring up something that's unexplained, and there's a very good guess that virtual reality and consciousness, just virtual reality by itself, will not explain, everything. But once you understand consciousness and how consciousness works, the two together will explain pretty much everything. We look at the paranormal things, you know, those things get explained. We see, you know, the fellow on YouTube, Dr. Emoto, who has water that he freezes, and he gets happy crystals and he gets ugly crystals based on how he's thinking. It explains things like that. And, I don't know, you name it, and there's an explanation for it. And you go into the physics, things like, let's see, what was it? They have several things there. Well, in quantum mechanics, we just have some new quantum mechanics experiments where they had some particles that indeed get detected, but at the same time they get a diffraction pattern. And that may not mean too much to you if you're not into, you know, double slit physics, but that's something that everybody thought was impossible. But then that's explainable too, just like the Big Bang. When you really understand how the big picture works, then it's easier to see how these other things work. And something more pedestrian, like what about the secret? You know, you use your mind to program the universe to give you what you want. You know, the power of positive thinking, those kinds of things. You know, how does that work? Well, it does work. You know, if you're a very negative person, you end up, you know, living in a very negative world. And if you're a positive person, then things tend to fall to you, what they call it, synchronicity, just when you need them and how you need them. And that's all, you know, part of the way reality works. It's all, you know, part of the process. And we mentioned things like a placebo effect. You know, that's a big mystery, has been for a long time. You know, how does that work? What about psychic healing? How do you heal someone with your mind? Well, there's a mechanism for that. You're just simply using intent to modify probable future reality, because this is not only a virtual reality that's on a computer, but it's a probabilistic virtual reality, not a deterministic reality.
Could I put an example onto that one and then throw it over to Anthony? Have you heard of fireburndoctor.com?
No.
No, this is very interesting. If you take down the number, I think I've got it on my phone here, and you get burned, like badly burned or whatever, you call Fireburn Doctor and you send him a picture or an email or something like that of the burn, and they heal it remotely. Instead of it costing millions of dollars and going through agonizing pain and having horrible disfigurement for the rest of your life, it just goes, it's gone in a couple of hours.
Well, this again is intriguing, because you could say it's an extreme form of the placebo effect, in the sense that, you know, we can do things that we're not really aware of in our everyday consciousness. But I'm very much thinking along the lines of something that Tom mentioned there about the twin slit experiment, and the idea that in some way the act of observation by a conscious being collapses what's called the wave function into a point particle. Now, in my next book, Mindfield, I'm going to be discussing some of the work of Thomas Hertog and Stephen Hawking. And they have come up in 2007 or 2008. They wrote a paper and they presented to the world something called the top-down hypothesis. And in the top-down hypothesis, now remember, this is Stephen Hawking, the world's leading research physicist, and we also have Thomas Hertog, who's a research scientist at CERN. And what they are saying is that, rather like Tom and I both agree with on this, is that everything is already encoded into what I would call the zero point field, or what Tom would call the field, or whatever we like to term it. But effectively, every potentiality is out there. And every decision we make collapses one wave function into one history. But all the other histories are all there. It's effectively the history that you follow. So effectively, you could collapse a wave function in which your hand has been healed. And in which case, that is a wave function collapse. So, and if we are living in a computer simulation, and if that computer simulation has within it encoded every single outcome of every single decision that can possibly be made, like a super-duper first-person DVD game, that's not so irrational and not so strange. The question is, we are not aware enough of being able to manipulate the reality around us in the way that possibly we might be able to do collectively, as more and more people become aware of the fact that consciousness is prime and reality is secondary, or physicality is secondary. I don't know what Tom's opinions would be on that.
Well, Tom, I would agree with the basics of it. It is true that in potentiality, all the things that are possible, all the things that could happen are enumerated in the sense of, you know, here's something that could happen and here's the probability that it will happen. So we have this thing called future probability database that gives us everything that could potentially happen and its probability. But that doesn't mean that all of these various probable realities do exist, in fact. That's a tremendous amount of overhead, if you will, in this big computer that we're talking about. That's an awful lot of computing to do, and it really doesn't have a lot of value. It doesn't give you anything back. It's much easier just to do it kind of in real time, that you compute the probabilities as people use their free will to make, you know, to make decisions. Now, the reason that, scientists, physicists have gotten into this many worlds theory is because, one, they have a sense that reality is deterministic, and therefore you have to determine everything, and you're just picking among the things that are already determined. And that's not really the case. I see it as a system that's based on free will, and that how that wave function collapses depends on what you do and the choices you make, and you have that free will. So it's all kind of a just-in-time, real-time program, if you will, as opposed to everything that's possible gets computed, and then we just go through this big matrix and select the, you know, select the reality that we want. That just seems like there's so much overhead and there's, and just, you know, not necessary to go there. It works just as well without all of that huge amount of computational resources involved.
I remember Tom, when you mentioned this, and we were discussing this when we had one of our interviews a few years ago, and it really profoundly affected me when you were using the analysis and the idea that the reality program, for want of a better word, is collapsed as you look at it. In other words, behind your head now, it doesn't need to be rendered in your universe effectively because you're not looking at it, unless I've misunderstood that. But as I understood that, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Now, it's just like the, you know, The Sims or the World of Warcraft or any other virtual reality you have. Everything isn't rendered all the time. Things are rendered by sending data streams out to individual customers. Individual players get a data stream that render what those players are looking at. So if you are not looking at what's behind you, then what's behind you, the computer doesn't have to render that for you. Now, if there's somebody else that is looking at that, then the computer has to render that for them, you see?
So basically, it's kind of like, I can only deal with what's in front of me. We'll cross that bridge till we come to it in a cosmic kind of way. And I was just thinking, as you guys were talking about this, about, you know, you mentioned if you're living positive and things will happen to you exactly when you need them. And for some reason, it reminded me of Andrew Jackson, I think he might have been a former president of the United States, but he got rid of the American bank type of thing, like the precursor to the Fed, and that was his one great life achievement. And he had a number of assassination attempts on his life. One in particular was when somebody came up to try and kill him, and they had not one but two pistols, and both of them misfired.
Yeah,
you know, I was just thinking about that as you were saying it. And I've got this perspective on reality myself, is that, as you said, Thomas, it's actually the decisions that we make that really make a huge difference. And I feel that perception is sort of a peripheral difference. Like it can make a change, sure, but it doesn't change things really entirely physically. Like, you can't create everything that happens in front of you. There's a framework, and there's decision making, and there's personal responsibility to go into it as well. It's not one or the other, it's everything altogether.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's the way it works is that you modify the future, you know, the probable future, let's put it that way. There's all these things that could happen, and what does happen, you help create what happens. You help make your reality several ways. And one way is that your intent changes the probability. So that's how you heal. You know, you talk about healing it's an intent that they look at that hand and they intend that it heal. And that intent modifies the probable reality of what's going to happen on that hand. It's sort of like that. That's the same thing that's going on with the placebo effect. The placebo effect isn't some kind of, charlatan's effect, you know, some mystical thing. The placebo effect is there just because that's the way consciousness works. Intent modifies probability. Now, let's say there's something that a lot of people are thinking very differently about. Well, some people are pushing probability this way, some are pushing probability that way. You know, things happen because we, the people, basically create it that way. You know, you look at this world and say, why is this world so messed up and so violent and so crazy? Well, it's because that's us, you know. That's the way we, the people, are. We're messed up. We're a little violent. We're crazy. So that's what we get because we create that for ourselves. You know, it's not that we're not here suffering, you know, unneedlessly. We're suffering because that's the way we are. You know, I'm not talking about us individually, but us as a species. You know, we're kind of all in this together, and everything is netted. Every consciousness is connected to every other consciousness. We're always in communications, and space and time make very little difference. So it doesn't matter that those people healing hands are on the other side of the planet or on another planet. It really doesn't matter because, you know, space is not real. Space is virtual.
Yeah, because this is a very important point, you know, that one of the areas that is still amazingly little known within the general public is the concept of non-locality. And again, non-locality was effectively proven back in 1981 in a very famous experiment done by a guy called Alan Aspect at the University of Paris Institute of Optics, where they proved something called the Einstein-Rosen-Podolsky experiment, or the thought experiment. And without going into any great detail about this, effectively what this meant was that everything is, once things have been entangled, whether subatomic particles or anything else, they can then instantaneously communicate with each other. Now, funnily enough, and Tom, I don't know if I'd mentioned this to you, but a couple of years ago, I had coffee with Professor Jeff Forshaw, who's one of Britain's leading particle physicists, one of the youngest as well. He's the professor of particle physics at Manchester University, where they split the atom. In fact, I met him in the very same building. And we had coffee. And over coffee, quite by chance, we were just discussing the EPR paradox and the Aspect experiment and the Bell inequality. And he turned around to me and he said, of course, we now know that every electron in the universe knows the position of every other electron. Now, sit back and think about that for a second. This effectively means that the universe is, in effect, a singularity, which means that everything is a singularity, which means it's all part of a great universal thing, which is one single thing. And funnily enough, one of the guys I'm going to be interviewing on my own radio station in a few weeks' time is Professor Bernard Haish, who's an American astrophysicist. And Haish has come out with a book called The God Theory. And in this, he's saying exactly the same thing. And of course, it's exactly what... we've run out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that is very interesting. If all the electrons know where each other is in the universe, then surely all the protons know where the rest of it is. And I think this is also why morons all cluster together. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
Black sunrise, black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide because the world's so full of chaos and madness and unexplainable things. If you lose your sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts. Now, there's a lot of things that happen in this world that you don't think is possible, and yet they happen anyway. And Tom was saying over the break that in a probabilistic reality, anything is possible. And I'm of the opinion that in a cannibalistic reality, anyone is edible. Anyway, we were talking about Anthony. You had a wee story about your wife falling down the stairs or something?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, in my book, The Labyrinth of Time, I deal with the illusion of time and the idea of what time is psychologically. But one of the incidents that I describe in the book, I found very difficult to understand in any objective way. And what happened was I was sitting at my computer. And again, if anybody's interested in this, if you go onto my Facebook page, if you go onto Anthony Peak on Facebook and you go onto my video, there's a video that will show the distance I moved when this occurred. But I was sitting at my computer and suddenly I heard a scream come from upstairs. And I thought to myself, oh, it's my wife. She's upstairs. She's found a spider in the bathroom. She's going crazy. But something, I sensed something was wrong. So I suddenly found myself running from the study, the 10 or so yards to the bottom of our staircase, because it's a very straight staircase. And as I got to the staircase, I saw my wife in mid-air coming down the stairs. And she'd lost her footing. And when the scream she had done, she told me, was when she lost her footing. I was at the bottom of the stairs and I caught her. Now, had I not caught her, she would have smashed her head on the side of a door and she would have probably killed herself. Now, we were discussing this just off air now, and Tom has a wonderful explanation for this, which that is the wonderful lead-in for Tom to give his My Big Toe explanation of this.
Well, you know, we have this belief in an objective causality. You know, everything is caused by something objective going on, and that's why these sorts of things seem impossible. You couldn't have possibly gotten there in time had you just started getting up out of your chair or being aware of the problem when she first lost her balance. Because unless you were sitting at the bottom of the stairs, you know, you couldn't have done that, because there's only probably a fraction of a second between losing your balance and, you know, being, like you say, in midair. And you're 10, 15 feet away sitting in a chair. It takes you a while to think, what's going on? Oh, that's a scream. Maybe it's a spider. I think I'll get up out of my chair. You know, all that takes time, and it wouldn't work out. So you say, that was just impossible. Well, it's nothing is impossible. Well, let me not say that. Almost nothing is impossible in a probabilistic reality, in a virtual reality. So here's a virtual reality. That scream you get is just something in your data stream. Remember, we mentioned that before, that what your reality is just the data stream you're getting from the computer. You're not, you're not in an objective reality. You're in a virtual reality. So you get this scream ahead of time. Why? Because if you didn't get it ahead of time, you wouldn't be able to catch her and save her life. So the system gives you a scream in your data stream. You hear it, start to react. You have this sense of, this is important. You need to get moving. That goes along with, you know, what's in your data stream. So it all works out. You know, these kind of impossible things happen to people all the time. People put their glasses and car keys down only to find them in places that they haven't been, you know, in the last couple of hours. You know, people, you know, like Vinny was saying, people will drive and suddenly go long distances in short periods of time. You know, they just have a time warp. Well, all of these things are not a problem. There's just a couple of rules about how this reality works to keep it consistent. And one is, you can't violate the rule set. The rule set's basically the rules that create the reality, right? If you're in a World of Warcraft, your character can't jump 100 feet in the air. Why? You know, the rules don't allow that. It's not in the rule set. So you have to abide by the physics here, because that's the rule set. Okay, and secondly is, you can't have any historical inconsistency, right? Now, had there been a bunch of people with movie cameras in Anthony's room watching his wife, taking pictures of his wife coming down the stairs, and at the same time a picture of him sitting at his desk, this couldn't have happened. Because you see, we would have had an inconsistency there. Something, quote, impossible, unquote, would have happened. Well, that's not allowed, but that wasn't like that. Anthony was there, the two of them were alone, you know. Something happens, it's unexplainable, and no big deal. See, it doesn't really cause any problems. So that's part of the thing I call the psi uncertainty principle. It has to do with when these psi events are allowable. So there are rules, there are structure. It's not just anything can happen anytime, but a whole lot of things can happen, you know, a lot of the time when you least expect it. And that's just the nature of reality. I just talked to a lady the other day. She said she had these two paring knives that she used all the time. She'd been using them for years. She set them down on a counter, turned around to do something, turned back. They were gone. She spent hours looking for them. They were gone. They never did return. You know, sometimes they'll show up, like, you know, in the bedroom, or, 2 days later, right exactly where you thought you left them. But, you know, you looked there already 3 or 4 times and they weren't there. You know, these things are common. Once you start talking to people about things like this, you'll find that probably 50% of the people you talk to can tell you about some really weird thing that happened to them once that didn't make any sense. And some of those are just imaginary, but a lot of them are real. You know, everybody isn't walking around a psychotic that, you know, their mind plays tricks on them. Most of these things.
Speak for yourself, Thomas. See, there's a bunch of things that come to mind when you do that. Like this coffee cup that I drink out of every day. For some reason, me and my girlfriend, we look for it. We can't find it, even though it's right there in front of us. I remember one time I was in the kitchen and I was looking desperately for this bottle of milk that I just bought. And I was looking around everywhere. Where the hell is it? Oh my God! I could have sworn I just had it. Where it was in my freaking hand, and I was looking for it for 15 minutes.
Finny, there's an explanation for that. You know, the anthropologist will turn around and give you an explanation for that. And I find it, for instance, I find it amazing that my wife will send me to the fridge to get a cup of some milk, and I'll be looking in the fridge and I can't see it, and suddenly this arm will shoot over my shoulder and grab it, and it's there. And my argument is, I'll say, oh, I couldn't see it because it's white. But apparently the explanation supposedly is, because we are males are gatherer hunters, effectively, because we're only not that long down from the trees, our role is to look into the distance and see wildebeests into the distance so we can go and hunt them. So we're looking in the distance, whereas women are programmed to look closely at a child and look closely at the details of a child's face. So they see detail and we don't. And that's why we can't talk and walk and chew at the same time as males, because we can't multitask in the same way. But it is an intriguing idea. And funnily enough, Tom's example there reminded me of Douglas Adams in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where he mentions that very phenomenon. I remember Tom mentioning that when we spoke once, and I thought it was an amazing analysis. But of course, Douglas Adams argued that, of course, what happened was millions and millions of years ago, there were these beings from the planet Biro, and they upset the Master of the Universe. And the Master of the Universe sent them all across the universe. You're just a diaspora of them. And effectively, they became Biropens. And all pens now want to get back to their home planet. So if you leave them on the desk and you don't look at them, they will jump off the desk because they're trying to get back to their home planet. So that's the explanation.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then there's that too. Huh?
Another couple of examples that I thought of was my mum, and I think I told you guys this over the break. Is there something to do with love here? Because, you know, Anthony, you love your wife, and then suddenly you were there to save her. And my mum loved my...
This.
Yeah, and my mum loved my little brother, and he was dressed in a Batman uniform, and he was trying to jump, or costume, sorry, and he was trying to jump off the garage, and she somehow knew from the other end of the property and ran over there and was there to catch him as he fell. So there's that kind of thing. And me, from my personal experience, I remember this dude, Shane Wenzel, I was involved with, just, you know, this psychopathic scumbag. And on my way to go see him one time, for some reason, I was just telling me, get in the car very, very quickly, like get the key in the door, crack it open, open the door, get in, get the key in the ignition and drive and get the hell out of here. And I was just leaving my house, you know, like there was nobody after me or anything like that. And later on, I think it might've been a couple of weeks later or something like that, I actually wound up exposing this guy for being a brutal, ruthless, sociopathic scumbag. And I did have to get into my car incredibly quickly, in exactly the same way.
Well, so that kind of thing happens. Yeah, you said, does love have something to do with it? Well, yes, it does, in the sense that I said we all communicate with each other. But, you know, okay, there's what now? 7 billion of us. That's a lot of chatter going on. So we kind of filter out all of that. We don't listen really to all of that. But we do listen to the people who are close to us, the people we love, the people we care most about, the people who are, you know, who want to kill us. You know, the things that are important to us kind of get through that filter. The things that aren't, don't. But we're all connected, and we're all connected all the time. But that's why your mom, you know, hears a child, because, you know, that's her baby, and she knows what's going on in that baby's life if it's something threatening. And, you know, that happens a whole lot. You know, mothers suddenly know, you know, they wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and say, something's wrong with my baby. You know, I mean, that's, you know, I don't know that every mother's had that experience, but it's pretty typical. Mothers know what's going on with that child, and the doctor doesn't have a clue, you know, but mom knows. And that's why we're connected.
I mean, doctors not having a clue is of no surprise to me. Sorry, Anthony, you?
I was going to say that you can extrapolate from that the idea of this whole concept of entanglement. I mean, I know you can't apply quantum physics to large, big objects like us, but there is an argument to say that if you spend a time with somebody. Like, for instance, a mother carries a child for 9 months in its womb. So therefore, they will become entangled in some way, and therefore there's the knowledge and the proximity there as well. So there's some kind of linking here as well. You just know when somebody you love is in trouble.
Yeah, and there's lots of recorded instances where twins, for example, will know when their other twin has just had an accident, or known when they've died or something like that. And I think that basically, if you live in a reductionist world, your ability to see the things that are in front of you and a blaringly obvious becomes reduced. You know?
That's the point I think Tom was making before. You know, the idea, if you live in a world that you don't believe in these things, they won't occur in your worldview.
And we'll be right back. Man, it's been a really good hour. And we've got another one coming up. Back in a minute.